On Tech News Today, the government wants technology companies to keep government requests for user data a secret, but increasingly, they're refusing to do it. Also, Google gets sued by people who say Android is anti-competitive, and Twitter is experimenting with a Google Plus feature from 2012. All that and more coming up next.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Tech News Today is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Tech News Today for Friday, May 2nd, 2014. This episode is brought to you by ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter makes hiring faster, easier, and cheaper. Post your job to 50-plus job boards with one click. Try ZipRecruiter for a free 4-day trial now at ZipRecruiter.com/TNT. That's ZipRecruiter.com/TNT. Welcome to Tech News Today. I'm Mike Elgin.
And I'm Jason Howell.
Tech News Today explores the big stories of the day in conversation with some of the world's best journalists. Our guest co-anchor today is Robert Scoble. Robert's a startup liaison officer for Rackspace, as well as a blogger, technology evangelist, and co-author of the book Age of Context. Welcome, Robert.
Hey, how are you doing? Great. Thanks for having me on the show.
Thanks for being here. Glad to see you have Google Glass. And shoot, I should have worn Google Glass today. We did an experiment, about a month and a half ago.
Yeah, it was a couple of months ago. It didn't work out so well.
We all wore Google Glass, and we can all put it together into one video, and then Jason's video was corrupted.
Which is weird. I've never had that happen with Glass, where I record an entire video, and then I go back to it, and there's no possible way of watching it or pulling it off or anything. So we'll try it again.
I did that with my drone, corrupted it, because on the DJI drone, if you turn it off before stopping the video recording, it corrupts the video.
Oh,
well, I hope you guys don't corrupt me, because I'm a good, clean person, and I don't want to be like your drone or like your Google Glass. We'll have to do another Google Glass edition one of these days.
Yeah.
All right. Well,
maybe when they improve it. I mean, I've been pretty brutal on Google Glass lately, because it really is a crappy product at a whole number of levels, but we can talk about that on
Twitter. Let's talk about it right now. Before we get into the news, let's talk about it, because you brought it up, and you've been in the news about this. Coachella, yeah, right, exactly. Yeah. You didn't bring Google Glass, and you saw the other glass holes there, and you sort of had a revelation about glass. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, well, I was standing at the Skrillex concert, and two guys in front of me said, "Man, one guy said to his friend, I got to get away from these Google Glass guys." I'm like, "I'm not wearing my Google Glass. So what are these two guys talking about?" I turn around, and there's two guys with glass on, and they're recording, so the lights on, and it looks freaky. It does look freaky. But it's just part of what's going on with this product. I think the tide is turning against it. Google just has launched it really badly, and I don't know how they get it back.
Well, you know, I have a couple of thoughts on that. One of them is that people talk about how clunky and dorky it looks, and it does, in fact, compared to the way people's faces normally look when they don't have glass on. But if you look at where this category has been coming, I've been following this trend sort of originating in MIT Media Labs and other places for, you know, 10, 15 years. And Google Glass is extremely small and elegant and socially acceptable compared to the incredible duct taped, clunky cables all over the place kind of experimental devices. So they've made progress technologically. But it's still definitely not there in terms of being socially acceptable. The other point that I wanted to make is that people object to Google Glass. They shouldn't object to it. They do, but they shouldn't. And the reason they shouldn't is because everybody's got a camera. All the logical reasons why people shouldn't object to it. But the reality is that they do.
Well, that was what was funny, because we were at Coachella and everybody's holding their phone up and recording. And there's a bunch of people with GoPros on sticks recording. So it's not the recording that they're objecting to. It's just freaky. And I think it's because there's actually a screen between my eye and your eye. And when it's lit up, it's even weirder. And when it's lit up, you want to look up at it and start paying attention to it. And that socially is still not a thing that's okay. It's now okay to pull out a phone at a restaurant and look at the screen down there, but it's not okay yet to wear one of these. But I don't know. I could go on for an hour about how this product is going to be roughly received in the general public, not because of the first impression. Almost everybody who wears it says, "Man, this is cool. I want one." But when they when they use it for a month and they realize, oh man, nearly every feature has a flaw in it right now. That's where I'm taking. I want the Google team to fix the flaws so I can actually say there's real utility, and there's not a whole lot of utility yet.
Yeah, well, that's a great point, and it'll be interesting to see where they go with it. My guess is that it'll mostly be a sort of a vertical integration thing. It won't be a mass market consumer.
Well, and if Google had launched it and said, you know, we're building something for surgeons and for cops and vertical markets, then I think we would all be much more accepting of the flaws. But they launched it as a general computing device that people are going to wear around in the street. And they launched it by jumping people out of planes and showing live video. And it still doesn't do live video unless you get a third-party app. And it really doesn't support very much live video anyways. Like you said, the thing corrupts, it gets hot, the battery only lasts 45 minutes, on and on. Anyways, I don't want to take this whole show and make it a glass hole show.
But. Yeah, that's a good idea. It is a news show, so why don't we do some news? How about that?
Yeah.
Why not?
So I'll take off my glass and we can talk about Facebook.
Leave them on, take them off, whatever you want. Well, the U.S. government doesn't want technology companies telling users about government data requests. Major companies like Apple, Microsoft, Facebook, Twitter, Yahoo, and Google used to comply with these requests, but increasingly they're changing their tune, or they're in the process of changing their tunes and their policies as well, to inform users directly flouting government requests, according to a report in the Washington Post by Craig Timberg, who's with us here today to explain the trend. Welcome, Craig.
Thanks for having me.
Well, now, Craig, what kind of data are the government requesting, and what do they request? You know, how do they request it? How does this process work, and why do they do it?
So police, prosecutors, civil agencies come with subpoenas all the time for data that can help them with their investigations. And if they want, for example, the contents of your email or what you've posted to Facebook, they actually need a search warrant, which is a pretty high standard. You need probable cause. But there's this whole other quite broad universe of data that's metadata, who you correspond with, what sort of phone numbers you put in with the user accounts, what IP addresses you use to log onto their services. And that historically has been gettable using a mere subpoena, which is not that hard to get. But increasingly, the companies are pushing back. They're saying, if you want this data, first of all, we're going to tell our users. And second of all, if it's at all possible, we're going to try to push for a search warrant, which is a higher standard.
Now, subpoena sounds like a pretty serious thing. And these requests are stamped right on the outside of the subpoena, right? How binding are they? Are they just simply requests, or are they legally binding in any way?
Depends what kind of subpoena they are. The FBI can issue something called a national security letter, and it has to do only with certain very high-level investigations. And those things are binding. They can be challenged in court, but never been done so successfully. But there's a whole very broad universe of subpoenas, tens of thousands of which go out to tech companies every year. And they, on the front, say, please don't tell your users that we're asking for their data. Tech companies used to abide by that, as telephone companies do, always have and still do. But the tech companies are really stop playing ball with this and increasingly are pushing back and saying, at the very minimum, we're going to tell our users before we turn over their data. That gives the users a chance to get a lawyer and go to court and try to stop it.
Now, what does telling users mean? Are they posting all of them somewhere publicly, or are they just going right after the individual user who's the subject of the subpoena?
No, they go right to the user. They'll send them an email and say, we've gotten such and such a query from such and such an agency. You have a certain amount of time to try to contest this. And then the tech companies don't want to be in the middle of it at that point, right? They're not going to get a lawyer to try to resist this. They don't want to let you know, and they're going to give you the chance to fight it in court if you want to. At the very least, though, you know that somebody important is looking at your data.
I mean, is this ethical? I mean, you know, if they're going after a terrorist and a drug kingpin and, you know, a violent murderer or whatever, and they issue the subpoena for the data, is it ethical for a tech company to sort of inform them and essentially warn them that they're being investigated?
So the companies will give you two answers to that question. The first is that if it's a serious matter, if notification is really going to screw up an investigation, you can always go to a judge and get that subpoena gag ordered. You can get a search warrant, which is routinely gag ordered. So it's not as though in every case users are being notified, but they're trying to force authorities to come with a higher level of proof before they block this sort of routine notification. The second answer they'll give is all of these policies have carve-outs for special exceptions. If there's a child in grave danger, if there's a terrorist attack that is imminent, the companies absolutely will turn over that data to the authorities very quickly. But they want to have the leverage to make those sorts of situations be the exception rather than the rule.
Robert Scoble, does that freak you out? Because, I mean, here we have tech companies deciding whether subpoenas or crimes or cases that are being investigated are worth, you know, they're being the judge and jury essentially by deciding themselves whether to warn or not warn the target of these investigations.
I think they want a little bit more information about what's being turned over. You know, these blanket orders are sort of not good for the tech industry. They don't engender trust with our customers. So I like it from that aspect. I just spoke to the surveillance community, about 4,500 people, and met with several of them. And I think most of the industry is well-meaning, and that industry is well-meaning and is actually trying to protect us. But God, it's a real hard thing to decide between or to moderate between both sides, because if I'm a spy and I want to spy on things, I don't want to tell you why I'm spying on you. I don't want you to be warned that you're being spied on, because you're going to change your behavior, right? And already that was some of the people talking to me off the record said, we already know that the terrorists have changed their behavior because of Edward Snowden, and so it's making their jobs a lot tougher, which probably is fair game.
Absolutely, and I think Edward Snowden has changed a lot of things, and one of them is probably, I would probably guess that Edward Snowden revelations have changed the public mood about government requests for data, and that's probably why these technology companies are revealing the data, precisely because the public mood has changed because of the Edward Snowden revelations. Yeah. Craig Timberg, do you think that's accurate?
There's no question that's true. Now, some of this goes back a couple of years as tech companies began to be a little more assertive, but the Snowden revelations were just a huge bomb in this industry, and they're fighting for customers all over the world. And if Google and Facebook and Apple are seen as sort of an arm of the government's investigative facilities, that's very bad for their businesses. So they're looking for ways to distance themselves a bit. This somewhat cozier relationship really grows out of the telecommunications industry. So the big phone companies always have complied pretty readily with police requests of all sorts. And the tech companies did that at first. But once this became huge front page news in the Washington Post and elsewhere, the tech companies decided it was time to really do this differently, to really be more transparent with users, to guard their privacy more carefully, and to create more of an arm's length relationships with the government.
Well, Craig Timberg, I want to thank you for coming on Tech News today. It was a great story, and I really appreciate you coming on and telling us more about it.
Thanks. It's been my pleasure.
All right. You can find Craig Timberg, at thewashingtonpost.com and also on Twitter at Craig Timberg. Well, in a sec, we're going to tell you about a lawsuit against Google. You're not going to believe that one. But first, I want to tell you about ZipRecruiter. You know, when you're going to fill a position in your small company, or if you're a hiring manager and you want to hire just the right person, there's probably only one best candidate for that job. There's one person who's better than all the others. And where is that person? Where are you going to find them? They could be on this job board or that job board. They could be on this social network or that social network. You don't know where they are. And that's why ZipRecruiter is the place to go to find that best candidate. How does that happen? With ZipRecruiter, you can post to 50-plus job sites at once with a single click. And I'll post on social networks as well, like LinkedIn, Facebook, Twitter, and Google+. And, of course, if you're going to post to that many sites, you're going to get flooded with all kinds of candidates, most of whom are not going to be people you want to hire. And so it's a lot of work to sort through all those, and ZipRecruiter helps you with that as well. They'll automatically highlight the best candidates, so all you have to do is go through the best candidates, not the unqualified candidates, and you screen them and you can rate them, and then you can hire the right person fast. It's the fastest way to hire the number one best candidate for your job opening, and it's the way to go. And really, hiring people is the most important job you have as a hiring manager. So try ZipRecruiter and find out why they've been used by over 100,000 businesses. Right now, our listeners can try ZipRecruiter for a free 4-day trial by going to ZipRecruiter.com/TNT. That's ZipRecruiter.com/TNT. We thank ZipRecruiter for their support of Tech News Today. Well, a class action lawsuit against Google says that Android violates antitrust laws and hurts competition. Specifically, Google requires Android handset makers to sign a contract called a Mobile Application Distribution Agreement, which requires them to bundle Gmail, YouTube, and a bunch of other Google apps. Google told Recode in a statement in opposition to this lawsuit that, quote, Anyone can use Android without Google, and anyone can use Google without Android. That's a nice quote. Robert Scoble, do you think this this lawsuit has any merit? I mean, after all, Google's gone to great pains, even to the extent of offering a version of Android that companies like Amazon can use, even to sort of take away customers from Google itself, and Google does nothing about it. So do they have a case here?
I don't think they do, but, man, getting into antitrust law is way over my pay grade.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because the antitrust is something that, you know, there are big antitrust cases and there are small ones. This is a small one. The big ones are, you know, Microsoft in the 90s, for example. I think you may have even worked at Microsoft during that period or even afterwards. And, you know, they were just hammered with this endless antitrust cases about something similar. It was bundling, right?
But in the Microsoft case, they use a product that did have a monopoly status, Windows, to push Internet Explorer. And that's how they got tripped up. Android, when it started out, had a minority market share. So Android was not a monopoly player when it first started up and grew to monopoly status. So I think it's a different kind of thing at this point. And also, it has very, very strong competition with Apple and other players, Microsoft. So there's less of a need to control the monopolist because I don't believe a monopoly really exists here yet. It's close, but in the United States, I don't believe a monopoly exists, and that's where this is going to be decided.
It's an interesting case because, I mean, if you look at the case of Microsoft in the 90s, yes, they had a monopoly sort of market share for Windows, but you could, you know, back at the time, in about an hour, you could just erase Windows off your PC and install Linux. And so they really didn't have a grip or a hold on the market. With Android handsets, it's a little more difficult to replace the operating system than it was with Windows. But as you said, it's not really a monopoly either. You have the iOS out there. You have all kinds of other alternatives. And of course, one of the biggest alternatives is the version of Android that doesn't come with this contract.
Yeah.
So
if you go to Xiaomi, you know, the new Chinese phone manufacturer, they don't care about this so much. Amazon doesn't care about these things so much. They're going to take Android in its own direction. And if Google is too controlling, they're just going to choose a different OS. Already Samsung is developing Tizen, right? So and it's trying to get a competitor going. And then there's Microsoft out there with Windows. So, you know, if Google tries to control the ecosystem too much, you'll see carriers and handset manufacturers go in a different direction.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, in other news, Twitter is experimenting with a new feature for its mobile apps that mutes certain accounts, a feature, Robert, that you and I have been using on Google Plus for more than 2 years. It enables you to continue to follow someone without getting their tweets. It's kind of a passive-aggressive way to unfollow someone in a way if you do it permanently. If you do it temporarily, it's a way just to shut somebody up for a while. Maybe they're live blogging something and you just don't want to see it. Is this a killer feature, and do you think they're going to roll it out, Robert Scoble?
I think it's a nice feature. I mean, like my friend MG Siegler, I love listening to MG, but I don't like listening to him when he goes on a sports tear. When he's watching one of his basketball games, he just tweets out dozens, sometimes hundreds of times about a game that I really don't care at all about. So I'd love to mute him for a couple hours and then come back when he's back on tech, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's a good feature, and I hope they do roll it out. It's really a way to put somebody's account on hold, as you said. And of course, third-party Twitter clients have supported this muting feature for a long time. And in fact, on TweetDeck, it's supposed to be one of the most popular features. So I think this is a case where Twitter is trying to catch up with the third-party applications for Twitter. So I hope they do this, and I think it'll be a good feature. Well, the Supreme Court this week considered two major technology issues. The first is whether the TV streaming service Aereo is legal or illegal. The second case looked at whether it's constitutional or unconstitutional for police to search mobile phones of suspects without a warrant. Electronic Frontier Foundation activist Parker Higgins wrote this week that in reviewing these cases, the Supreme Court justices revealed what he considers a dangerous ignorance about how people use technology, and he joins us here today to explain. Welcome.
Hi, thank you.
So what did the Supreme Court justices say this week that revealed their ignorance about how people use technology?
Right. So I think there's two kinds of classes of things that people are talking about. In the Aereo argument, there were some funny moments where Sotomayor, for example, misspoke and said she made up services like iDrop by accident. And I think that that's like an okay, that's, you know, they don't have to be technology experts. But this week, with the phone searching cases, we had situations where Chief Justice Roberts and Justice Scalia kind of scoffed at the idea that somebody might carry two cell phones. They said that a person had been searched and was carrying two cell phones, and they knew this was an area where people were dealing drugs. And so they said, well, I mean, that's kind of grounds to be suspicious, right? And, you know, half of my friends carry two cell phones, and I'm sure that half of the people in the court that day were carrying two cell phones because they're lawyers that, you know, have a work cell phone and a home cell phone. And that sort of thing, where a decision might turn on this misunderstood fact about the way that people use cell phones, among other things, is really alarming.
Well, as you said, you don't really believe that it's the job of the Supreme Court justices to have a mastery about technology itself. What's important is to be in touch with how people use technology. But isn't that a lot to ask Supreme Court justices? I mean, if you know, they're elites, they're probably pretty wealthy. They as you pointed out in your article, they don't have to scrounge for work. You know, they have lifelong jobs and so on. They're different from the rest of us to a certain extent. Doesn't that apply to almost all areas of law? I mean, for example, if they're out of touch with mainstream American life, they're going to be out of touch when the case is not about technology, when it's about, you know, food or anything, you know, so cars, safety, workplace safety, whatever. They're going to be out of touch with all of those things. What's special about technology that makes you think that they really ought to get in touch with how people use this stuff?
Well, I think what sets technology apart here, and you're absolutely right that this is an issue of having nine elites make these decisions. But what sets technology apart is that technology kind of mediates a lot of other sections of our life. And so you get these privacy questions that come from technology. You get freedom of speech questions that come from technology. And technology really is not, the question isn't about cell phones. It's about privacy, but cell phones sit in the middle. And we've seen a real uptick. I mean, this at EFF, this session of the Supreme Court has been the closest we've ever had to follow it, because every week they're arguing something that we're involved with. And we expect to see more and more of that as the Supreme Court takes on technology as just as the middle step of really rights and freedoms that we hold dear on the other side.
Now, Robert Scoble, I think you'll agree with me when I say that one of the things that bothers me about Supreme Court justices looking at cases like the Aereo case is they're deciding the future of technology innovation, and that future may be determined by, as we're learning this week, a lot of ignorance about how people use technology and about the technology itself and about the industry itself and about maybe they don't have a sufficient appreciation for the process of innovation or how disruption works and the importance of disruption, et cetera. What do you think about this case?
Well, and there's a generation gap that really does come out when I talk to older people versus kids. They view the world of technology very differently. What's funny is every congressperson has two cell phones, one for governance and one for raising money. So maybe they should talk to the politicians that put them in office in the first place and see the realities of the modern world. I have three cell phones, so I guess I'm under suspicion.
Yeah, you're highly.
Yeah, I think it's a deep problem with all of our people who govern us that they just are not very astute on technology, and they're being asked to come up with laws that about things that they just deeply don't understand. And I've met with six congresspeople, I met with the FCC commissioner, and on and on. These are people who are doing as good as they can, but they certainly are not very, very deep in their understanding of how we use tech and where it could go.
Now, Parker Higgins, what's the solution here? What would you recommend for the Supreme Court? How do they learn how people use technology? Is there a remedy here?
Well, there's no silver bullet. I think that it's important, and we've seen this a lot, that when lawyers are briefing these cases, this is information that they should be bringing to the table. That, but at the same time, I think in part it comes to having a relationship with your judicial clerks that might understand how this works. They're a little younger, maybe a little more tech savvy. And I think it's going to be there's going to be a period of kind of rough transition.
Maybe we need a couple of teenagers on the Supreme Court. That'd be cool. Well, Parker Higgins, I want to thank you for coming on Tech News today.
Thank you.
You can find Parker Higgins at parkerhiggins.net and on Twitter with the unusual Twitter handle XOR. Thanks again.
Thank you.
Now, Robert, I wanted to talk to you a little bit about a couple of stories that have been in the news lately. And I don't have a news story to read, but I wanted to have a conversation with you about social networks dying or on their last legs or being walking dead, et cetera. I'm talking, of course, about Google Plus and Twitter, both of which have been called out as dying social networks, and mostly because they're not as huge as Facebook. Is this a bunch of BS, or is there something to all this social networks dying talk?
Mostly it's a bunch of BS by people who really don't use these social networks and don't see the value in them. But there is something there. I mean, when I go to a baseball game or a music festival or watch TV now, I hear Facebook and Twitter. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter and sometimes Instagram. Very rarely do I hear Google Plus mentioned in that space. And when I talk to my normal friends, none of them are really using Google Plus, and very few of them are using Twitter. So there's something there that Twitter, both Twitter and Google Plus, need to figure out. And it sounds like Google Plus is moving resources away from the Google Plus team and onto other projects. So maybe Google has decided where we don't really care about being in the top two social networks anymore. We're going to focus more on where we can really provide some value, i.e. Android or Chromebooks or one of the other projects that Google has. So there is something to it, but for the most part, I don't see these things going away anytime soon. I mean, my friend runs this company called Vintank that studies how often we talk about wine on social networks. And he says they see 1.1 million tweets a day about wine. So somebody is out there using these products and getting a lot of value out of them.
Yeah, drunk people.
That's just one little small thing, I mean, I get a lot of value out of all of them. Yesterday I linked to Google Plus and showed off animated GIFs that are automatically made. The other services don't yet do that. And photos, when I put my Coachella pictures up on Google Plus and on Facebook, they were noticeably better quality on Google Plus. So I hope that there continues to be a competition, even though I personally have poured most of my time into Facebook. So I sort of agree with the conclusion that Facebook is winning most of our time and effort. If you want to study the kids, I was hanging out with 20-year-olds at Coachella and watching what they were using on their phones, and I saw a lot of Snapchat, I saw a lot of Instagram, and a little bit of Facebook, but not a whole lot of other things. And that's got to be troubling for the product planners at Twitter and at Google Plus.
My own perspective is that Facebook kind of skews our thinking about it all. If you can imagine the social service world without Facebook, Google Plus and Twitter would be doing great. They would be huge. Yeah. But the fact that everybody is on Facebook, and I've talked before about Facebook having a monopoly on everybody. You have to be on Facebook because everybody has to be on Facebook. And everybody is there, and so you have to be there, and that's why everybody's there. That sort of thing. It's a circular reinforced thing. They happen to come into the mainstream right at the moment when everybody's grandparents and parents and everybody was getting on social media, and they were the flavor of the month during that month, and now they have a permanent sort of majority, which is fine.
They were the first ones to really get your real friend graft, which is sort of funny because Google actually had it all back. If you look at the time before Facebook, Google really understood my social graph because of email and people I emailed with. But Facebook stole all that data and put it into Facebook and then got us to add more And so now all my family and friends are on Facebook, and most of the industry. I mean, when I compare which entrepreneurs are on which services, I see them mostly on Facebook. So, and that's who I want to reach. So it's pretty crazy.
Yeah, it's crazy. And, you know, I think it's funny sometimes when you when people who are into Twitter, which is people, you know, really our peers in the media, a lot of celebrities, lots of people who are into sort of broadcasting their thoughts or sending out links and promoting links. Those kinds of people are tend to be really into Twitter, and they're shocked to learn that Google Plus is probably a little bit more active than Twitter. And the reason is that Google Plus is active among a different type of person, not the people with the megaphones. Twitter is a megaphone. So people who want a megaphone use Twitter. And they're always shocked to see the size of Google Plus and the activity level at Google Plus. There's been some recent research coming out showing that it's, you know, it's a bit bigger than Twitter. And it sort of stuns the people who feel that everyone they know is on Twitter and no one they know is on Google Plus. It's because they know other megaphone holders.
It's dangerous to get religious in this world about distribution. Because there's a lot of people on LinkedIn, and there's a lot of people on Pinterest, and there's a lot of people on Quora. I mean, every time I answer a question on Quora, you should see my email light up, you know? And so it's dangerous to get religious about this. But I think what we're talking about is the business models for each company. And Twitter should be growing faster than Facebook at this time because it has a far smaller audience. So there's more people to absorb into the service. You know, Facebook pretty much has everybody in the modern world on Facebook already, and it's going to be really tough for Facebook to grow the numbers of people, although they continue to do that, which is crazy, right? Twitter should be growing faster, and it's not, and that's a problem for Twitter's business and something for Dick Costolo to figure out. The real problem, though, is what you nailed, the network effect of having your family and friends on a service. And Twitter just doesn't have that tight tie to other people. You don't put your friends in there the same way. You follow celebrities or TV shows or news brands, you know? I mean, many of you probably follow Twit and find out about the Twit show there. But Facebook knows your family and friends and coworkers, and it's a whole nother thing.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, in a related story, we told you yesterday about new features in the Snapchat app that enable users to seamlessly move between chats, texting, and video. Well, today an article on the New York Magazine site by Kevin Roos says that the new Snapchat is causing huge disruption in America's high schools, and suddenly. And by disruption, of course, I mean both the technology kind, where patterns of usage are radically altered, and also disruption in the traditional sense in terms of disrupting class, as in, you know, depriving others of their education. One high school science teacher in Kansas said, quote, "In 16 years of teaching, I can't think of anything that has ever disrupted my classroom more than today's Snapchat update." She had to take away the students' phones, and she said, because, quote, "They seriously could not keep away from it. I had one girl even crawl under the table with her phone," unquote. This sounds pretty compelling and addictive, Robert Scobel. Do you think this is going to really drive a lot of usage of Snapchat now that high school students are going nuts over it?
Yeah, it got me back on. I have a 20-year-old, and I noticed at Coachella he was using Snapchat with all his friends. It's like, hey, okay, this is how I am going to talk to my teenager from now on. Or my young adult. When they got the video feature, we tested out, and it's pretty well done.
And the user interface is really, really nice. And once again, like Facebook's, their anonymous login feature, like so many other things that other companies are doing, the Snapchat update always makes me think, Google, why don't you do this? Why don't you do this with Hangouts, for example?
Yeah.
It's very frustrating.
Well, you know, Hangouts are heavier weight. Hangouts are great if you want to talk to 8 or 9 people, but it's not as fast, and it's not made for the mobile phone, you know, and it's not something you can just click on a name and call them and have that thing. And then, let's be honest, it's from a big company that we're not yet trusting with our private, you know, most intimate kind of video. Let's go there.
Teens probably want to be somewhere where no one else is, and especially where adults are not. And adults are at Google using Google services. So.
Yeah, and Facebook, right?
Yeah.
You know, because Facebook's Messenger does pretty much the same kind of thing, and I personally like Facebook Messenger. If I want to hear from everybody, please do it on Facebook rather than on Snapchat. But I totally understand why the kids are on Snapchat, and that's going to drag in the rest of us. So I see a good future for Snapchat, particularly if they keep building features that are well designed, and this one. Even my son says, man, Snapchat used to be really ugly and janky, and now it's growing up and becoming very beautiful and easy to use.
Well, Robert Scoble, I want to thank you for coming on Tech News today and sharing your insights with us. I always appreciate it. And I want to have you back, and we should do that glasshole edition where all of us are wearing Google Glass, videotaping everyone in sight, and just see what happens.
I don't know. I'm wearing them less and less. I'm playing around with other wearables like this narrative clip that's taking a picture every 30 seconds, just in case you're not freaked out about me enough wearing all this stuff.
Have you ever tried clipping it on the back so you can have both the front view with Google Glass and
that's
have
a great
rear view
idea,
mirror?
You know?
Yeah. I'll suggest it to Leo as well. He's got one of those narrative clips. I like the idea of sort of life logging. It's a interesting idea. I don't think the narrative clip takes enough pictures. Once every 30 seconds or something, right?
Well, and you can double click on it or tap it, and it'll bring that up. It is fun to go back and look through yesterday's pictures. You know, let me see if I can get the app up here, and it lets you scroll through all the pictures that it shot. And it's sort of fun, but most of the pictures are really crappy.
Yeah, it's pictures of you brushing your teeth and like.
Yeah, pictures of me answering email. I mean, let me tell you, that is not the most entertaining thing you'll ever watch.
Yeah, right. That's right. But it's good. It's good data for the NSA to harvest, you know, and enhance, you know, and then they can read your email if they don't already have a direct connection.
I'm not too worried about the NSA.
All right.
Well, they got better things to do.
Well, Robert, where can people find your work, and also where can people find your book?
Just search for Scoble, Scoble, and I'm all over the place. Twitter, Facebook, Google+, Snapchat, LinkedIn, Quora, elsewhere.
All right. Robert Scoble, the Scobalizer, thanks again. And
thanks.
Really appreciate it.
YouTube. What I really do is interview tech executives, and I put those interviews up on YouTube for Rackspace. So.
I love that, too, because what happens is you interview people when nobody's ever heard of them. And then 2 years later, when they're bought by Facebook for $5 billion, you're like, well, here they were when they were still a scrappy startup.
This week at the Facebook F8 conference, he had three companies up on stage. One was Quip, Brett Taylor's company, which makes sense. And one was SoundCloud. And I have videos of both companies. So, yeah.
That's very cool. Very cool thing you do there. And I appreciate you coming on.
Thanks.
All right. Well, there are lots of ways to subscribe to Tech News Today. Snapchat is not one of them, but you can go to twit.tv/TNT. That's right. Yet. You can go to twit.tv/TNT. You can go to youtube.com/Tech News Today. And you can go to Twitter and find our handle, Tech News Today TV. Also, don't miss our evening newscast, Tech News Tonight at 4 p.m. Pacific tonight. Jason, you're the guy tonight, right?
That's right.
All right. I'll be there. Jason tonight and every weeknight. My name is Mike Elgin. Thanks for tuning in. We'll see you Monday.